takes a few seconds for it to kind of regulate.
Like Warren G?
No. Random reference.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the right... Warren G and the Regulators, right?
Is that his band?
What? What the fuck?
Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Keith Foster from San Diego, California.
What? Sorry, you're waiting for an intro too. Yeah. You are Cassidy Robinson from Los Angeles, California.
Yes.
No, we can't record yet. How the fuck do you not know Warren G and the Regulators? That's like old school.
I know Warren G was like a hip hop artist from the 90s, but that's literally all I know about him. I couldn't tell you a single song.
No, you know, as soon as you hear it, you're gonna say, "I'm a dumb dick." I'm serious. Like, you might need to just...
You know that video, you know that one Portlandia sketch where Fred Armisen tells Carrie Brownstein that he missed hip-hop and she has to explain the history of hip-hop to him? That's kind of me. Like, not totally, but pretty close.
I think I know the milestones.
Right. I can tell you, like...
Warren G is a milestone. Tupac.
Yeah, for some people, but I would still say he's like a tertiary.
Whoa. What do you mean, some people?
I meant for people who are like into it, who know more than just like the ones who got killed famously.
Warren G.
Or who are Eminem. I did watch that Hip Hop Evolution show on Netflix, and I felt very educated by it.
Yeah.
I wish they'd do more episodes of it, actually. It was really good.
I've been watching one. It's a documentary on toys.
I saw the app. I saw the
the
icon for that. Yeah.
It's pretty enthralling. They said it's an 8-part series, but it looks like only 4 parts are out yet.
Okay.
So I watched the one on Star Wars, Barbie, and He-Man.
So there's like, it's a show, there's episodes.
Yeah. I mean, they're like 45 minute.
That is interesting.
Little dot. I think it's because there's not enough about each individual story, unless you want to start getting into like all the rare figures and shit like that.
Right. Or like Furby or Tickle Me Elmo or something like that.
Yeah. No, this is mostly about like the milestones from the 80s and mm-hmm. like the 70s. How was your Christmas?
It was fine. You know, I didn't really have much to do, but my friend Amanda, mm-hmm. who was down here, she already did Christmas with her family because she went to Florida where her parents live, and they kind of did a Christmas Thanksgiving combination while she was down there.
Okay.
So we went and saw Star Wars because she hadn't seen it yet, and then we had Chinese food. So, was yours?
It was good. It was good. We just stayed home. It was the first year that both me and my wife didn't have to work. So it was like mm-hmm. we both got the day off. We adopted a cat.
You have another cat now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a stray. It was just like hanging out outside our house for like a week. And mm-hmm. just like meowing and... We finally found it, and it was like just a little kitten, like maybe a year old. And uh-huh. so we took it to the shelter, and they scanned for a microchip, and she didn't have one, and she wasn't neutered. So they were like, "We'll adopt her to you if you want." And she's just really sweet, so we did it. Her name is Stay Puffed Marshmallow Mathers LP the first.
Oh my. What's her real name though?
Marshmallow.
Okay. That's acceptable. Yeah. I'll allow it. Okay, so today we're going to be talking about The Disaster Artist. And I'm going to do a solo review about Tanya Harding, another 90s celebrity. And at the end of the program...
Hold on. You just said another 90s celebrity, but you're cutting out all the stuff about Warren G.
No, don't worry about it. It's all in my head. It's all there.
Leave that in just so the listeners are like, what the fuck is going on this episode?
Nothing is going on. And at the end of the show, we're going to review White Christmas, which mm-hmm. I assigned you last week when it was still pre-Christmas.
Yeah, I didn't think about that we'd be recording this after, but it's fine.
I feel like it's still okay. Like, people, like, the rule is, right, that you don't take your Christmas lights out until New Year's.
Yeah.
Same thing with talking about Christmas movies.
Yeah, I feel like it's good to have, like, it's called the Christmas season. Mm-hmm. I like that there's a build-up to Christmas, and then, you know, there's a little leeway for a come-down.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a Christmas refractory period. So let's go ahead and get into our pet topic. We have no movie news this week. The Hollywood shut down for the holiday, so they're not really releasing a lot of movie news, except for Mad About You's coming back. I'm a fan of Mad About You, and I don't give a fuck.
Fart noise.
But we're going to talk about our movie resolutions. This could be resolutions to Hollywood, resolutions for ourselves in regards to movies, or anything. Anything. Pretty open-ended. I think I've done this once with Richard a few years ago.
All right.
I don't remember how it went, so we'll try it again. but I'll let you start. What is one of your movie resolutions?
So this is my big one. This is for Hollywood. I want trailers to stop thinking that they can get away with just, like, showing random shots of the movie with, like, a slowed down minor chord version of an old popular song.
Oh, thank you. Oh, yeah. That's so good. It should have been mine.
It's such a cheap move. And like, if it's a song you like, it's effective. Mm. But I'm over it. I think the one I was over it was, I think it was something that came out this year. Might have been. Oh, I think it was Valerian, the trailer.
I don't remember.
It was that Beatles song.
Because? Yesterday, maybe? I don't know.
Is it called Because?
Oh, Because, yeah.
Yeah, that was Elliot
the one Smith
where
did the
like,
cover of.
Yeah, I'm done.
No, they yes, you're right. That has been a trailer trope for a while. Almost as tired as the Wom Woms. And
I prefer Wom Woms.
You prefer the Zimmer Woms?
I prefer Zimmer Woms because it's less obviously manipulative.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, here's the thing. Every once in a while, it can make for a really cool trailer. The Stranger Things Thriller remix was really cool. But the slowed down cover of...
The ironically...
Itsy spider goes up a water spout. Yeah. Done.
Yeah,
with
I
it.
Know. We've seen it 1,000 times, and it's really stupid. You're right. I commend you. That's really, really, really good. Mine are not as cool. This one is kind of pretty broad, but it's something I've wanted to see for a while. So I'm going to keep saying it until I see more of it. More anthology movies, or a return to them. I think, speaking of Twitter, I tweeted a long time ago, I'd love to see an anthology movie, like a New York Stories style or Paris Je T'aime style anthology film where Four Rooms, whatever, pick your movie, where Greta Gerwig, Sofia Coppola, Ava DuVernay, and
ooh, yeah,
somebody else, Sarah Pauly. All got to do, like, you know, a short.
Yeah, I'd be into that.
Yeah.
It'd be really cool. Also, I think if... I know this will never happen in a million years. Never, ever, mm-hmm. ever. But I think it'd be cool to try and get like more artsy and experimental with like the Marvel universe and do something like that. Like,
yeah,
do-
like maybe there's some properties in which they can't really right at this point justify doing full features, or there's just not enough story well, there. Story
and they
ideas.
Used to do those shorts as like the DVD exclusives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like do a few of those and sort of string them together as one theater release movie, I think would be really cool. And I think it would kind of shut some of the critics up about superhero fatigue. I get it. Yeah. It will never happen. Also, like, you know, maybe Star Wars, if we're going to do an expanded universe for that beyond the trilogy. Yeah.
It doesn't have to be super artsy and auteur-y. It can be, like, you know, obviously the most popular thing for anthology films is usually horror films.
Yeah.
Like, those are the ones that kind of get away with it the most, because there's, like, the VHS movies well, or Trilogy of Terror or whatever.
And
that's
those,
fine. I like those, too.
And those type of movies aren't... I get it. You know, they're not going to bring in a big budget. But I agree. Anthology movies. Let's see some
more of those. Yeah. Okay. What's another one you have?
Mine was another trailer related. This one's a little more tangentially related. But it's that we all have to collectively stop referencing Mr. Movie Voice, Epic Movie okay. Voice Man.
Yeah,
because,
yeah, yeah.
I don't think a trailer has had Epic Movie Voice Man in an actual theatrical trailer since like 1998.
Yeah, it is. It's weird that it's still a common trope used in like comedy or whatever.
Yeah,
but it hasn't been a thing for almost as long as anybody who's going to movies now.
There's one exception. Honest Trailers, the YouTube yep. channel, can still do it because they've established their own brand with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're still allowed. Everybody else, off limits. I cannot tell you how many like insurance commercials I've heard mm-hmm. where they try to sell you insurance like this in a world where people don't even get what you're fucking referencing.
Right. I think I've seen it. You know where I see it the most used, ironically, is at the movies. Because I think people think like, oh, this is going to be showing in front of such and such blockbuster. Let's do it like a trailer. That's their pitch, as if they haven't got that pitch 1,000 times.
Yeah.
And so they always do it like, you know, it could be about like selling popcorn or a car or whatever. And it's always done in that style. But you're right. It is funny. Like, I think I have like genuinely heard Movie Voice like maybe 2 or 3 times in the last 10 or so years. And it was always jarring when it happened. Like, whoa, we're doing that again.
Yeah. And I mostly hear it on the radio, oddly enough. Which, well,
that makes sense, though, because obviously you don't have visuals for radio.
Yeah, but that it's weird because it's an audio medium referencing a visual medium. From a 10-year-old right. trope.
Matt Damon wants to be small.
Yeah, or okay, there's a caveat that I'll pose. We can start referencing Mr. Movie Voice again if trailers start using Movie Voice again.
All right.
I actually wouldn't be totally opposed to that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a trailer for The Shape of Water, by the way.
Yeah.
And this was after we'd seen it. And it literally goes through the whole movie beat by beat.
Oh, I remember seeing the trailer before I saw the movie. And I got the point. Like, I can feel when I know enough about the movie that I want to see it. Like, and I could tell that it was going to overdo it. So I just plugged my ears and closed my eyes and started humming to myself because I knew that it was going into full-on spoiler territory.
Yeah, full-on. Like, it even goes up to the end of the movie, basically. And, shows certain characters dying, and I'm like, what the fuck? Like, I was very happy that I didn't see that before the movie because I would have been pissed.
I knew that was coming. That's
but, you know, it. If that had been just in a world where a mute lady fucks a fish, I would have been fine. I would have been like, all right, I'm going to see that. Guillermo del Toro's doing something weird.
Mm-hmm. All right. My next one is very specific to this year, I feel. I want movies to stop spelling out the subtext in a monologue. I felt like I've seen that 5 or 6 times this year in otherwise really good movies, or even some shitty ones too, where I get it, man. I know what you're saying. This isn't like really difficult. And then at some point, the movie like stops for a beat to say, for one of the characters to literally start soliloquying the meaning of the movie.
Yeah. Do you have a specific reference?
Lady Bird, which I loved a lot, did this. I think I
at the very, very end.
Yeah. Which, if they're gonna do it somewhere, that's the place to put it. But still, it was too much. I think even I, Tonya, which I just saw, has it. I think there was some blockbuster I saw recently where they did it, and I was just like, Jesus Christ, what is it with this year, this happening all the time? Like, stop it.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is cinema. Actually, I think it might have been Star Wars where this happened too. I mean, it's literally like it's come up like over and over again.
There were a couple moments in Star Wars. I will say that as much as I liked Star Wars, it did get a little like, okay, like I get it.
Yeah, I kind of give that a pass because it's Star Wars and they've never been known for subtlety when it comes to their themes.
Yeah.
But there have been some otherwise really great or smart movies that didn't need to do that and did it anyway. So that's one of mine. You have any others?
Yeah, I have one more. Again, trailer related. I have a theme.
Okay. I like it.
Stop, for the love of Christ. For the love of my sanity.
Mm-hmm.
Stop doing teasers for trailers. I know I ranted about this.
Trailer trailers?
Yeah. I know I ranted about this a little bit with Avengers. Mm-hmm. Nothing makes my fucking blood boil. Like, when I see an article come up in my feed and it's like, trailers coming out for whatever bullshit on Sunday. Check out the 20-second teaser here. I'm like, no, just give me the 20-second teaser and then I'll judge the movie on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But no, no more teasers for trailers. Dunzo.
I really wish that would be an option. I really wish we could do that. But unfortunately, that's just part of the game now.
No.
Because there's so much stiff competition every weekend, especially for blockbusters, because it's five movies that have to somehow make $3 billion a weekend.
If Disney hadn't announced that it was releasing the trailer for Infinity War, and had they just dropped the trailer, do you think people wouldn't have fucking watched that shit?
No, of course not.
Exactly. They're insane. Yeah. It's stupid. If anything, I mean, there are certain movies that I kind of get needing to drive up the hype, like a Marvel competitor or a Star Wars competitor, basically the Disney competitor at this point.
Yeah.
I kind of get. It's like, sure, I can make a case for fucking Tom Cruise's The Mummy. I don't like it, but that makes a little more sense. You know, like, you gotta get those clicks. Mm-hmm. But, like, Star Wars, fuck off. Fuck off. You don't even need to release a trailer.
No.
You don't. So shut the fuck up and just give me my movie. Like, I'm done. Done with...
Says the guy who sleeps on the ground overnight at Comic-Con to see trailers.
It's a different thing, man. It's a different thing. It's like, this is like me complaining. Right now you're comparing, it's like seeing Radiohead live compared to hearing a Radiohead song on the radio. No, that's even not a good example. It's like seeing Radiohead live.
Uh-huh.
Versus hearing a snippet of a Radiohead song in a car commercial. That's the difference.
I don't think it's exactly like that.
It's pretty close.
Okay, this is my last one, and this is a resolution for me.
You're not capable of change.
This is the type of thing I could probably change. I just got the movie pass.
Yeah.
And you know, you're allowed to see 30 movies a month, you know, one a day for $10 a month. So I want to make a concerted effort this year to see more comedies and see more animated films because I've always been kind of crunchy with my money.
Oh yeah.
I are a little frugal. I, you know, those are the genres I tend to kind of skip over. I'm like, if I hear a lot about it, I maybe will see it. But even then I usually don't because they in those genres don't always benefit from seeing it in the theater as much as other ones. And more often times they're kind of garbagey, but now that I have it, I have no excuse. So yeah. I'll probably try and see more animated films and comedies this year.
That's a good one.
So, and I figured this kind of goes without saying, but let's all just stop raping each other for a second.
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring that up. Yeah. Because that's...
super bummer.
It's not even...
And obvious.
Yeah. Mostly obvious, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. I...
Yeah, I mean, I, the only reason I bring it up is because it'd be slightly weird not to, because I think everyone's kind of waiting for us, one of us to say it. So there, I said it. It's acknowledged.
We can move on from it. Are people waiting for us to say it?
I mean, when we're talking about what Hollywood can do better in 2018, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, let's you're just, right. Please stop.
Let's stop that for a little bit.
Or forever. That'd be cool too.
Yeah. All right. That's that segment. Let's go ahead and get into our reviews. And I'm going to start with a solo review for I, Tonya. So I saw I, Tonya over the weekend. I wanted to see it before I wasn't thinking about it anymore. But get this. I was talking to friend of the show, Ashley Hitchcock, about having just seen it via the internet. And she said to me, "Who's Tonya Harding?"
Yeah, that's not that surprising to me.
It was a little bit to me. I know that, you know, she's 5 or so years younger than us.
No, that'd be like saying to someone who's still in their 20s, like, explain to me the Menendez murders. Like, that wasn't... Honestly, we were only sort of peripherally aware of that stuff. I mean, OJ's different. OJ was like everyone.
That was the tabloid story to beat them all.
Create them all. But yeah,
I want to conduct a test right now. Your wife is the same age. Mm-hmm. Ask her right now if she knows who Tonya Harding is.
Go ask her.
Yeah.
Do you want me to record it?
Yeah, we'll keep it on the air. You can just open the door and yell at her.
Well, she has a friend over. Hold on. Did you hear any of that?
A little bit. What was the...
Yes, she knows who she is. I asked her to describe her in one word.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "Well, that's hard. It's 2 words. And I said, just say it. And she said, "Lead pipe."
Okay.
So well, she knows more...
She knows enough.
Yeah.
She knows enough. So I'll explain to the audience who Tonya Harding is in case they don't know. Tonya Harding was an ice skater in the early 90s. She participated in the 94 Olympics. 94. It's kind of fuzzy because, and I'll get into it. She was in the center of a controversy where her main rival, Nancy Kerrigan,
94,
was attacked during one of her tryouts by a mysterious hitman and clubbed in the knee. And of course, a lot of people thought that it could be Tonya Harding because she kind of comes from this sketchy, kind of rednecky background. And her boyfriend was sort of kind of a weirdo. And they were being sort of cagey about whether or not they were involved in it. You know, it went all the way up to, you know, police reports and the FBI and all this other stuff kind of looking into it. And, you know, reports came back. And it did have something to do with her boyfriend. Now, the interesting thing that this movie does, directed by Craig Gillespie, is the actual incident itself is sort of broken up in a sort of social network Rashomon-y type of way, where since there's so many different stories as to depending on who you ask, if you ask the hitman, if you ask her husband, I should say, her husband at the time, and Tonya Harding.
A literal hitman.
Yes, a literal hitman. If you ask each of them, they have a slightly different version of the story, depending on which version of them is going to get them in less trouble. And, you know, stories that they've stuck to since the incident itself. But I remember this being a huge thing because I actually did kind of sort of pay attention to Winter Olympics at that time. And even watching this, I remember there's a scene in which the announcers in the background mention Oksana Baiul. And I was like, ooh, Oksana Baiul. I haven't heard that name in years.
All right.
She was, so this stars Margot Robbie in the lead. And she also produced this movie and helped get it made. Sebastian Stan plays her abusive husband, Jeff Galooly. Allison Janney plays her abusive mother, LaVon Golden. And it pretty much it's a biopic that starts from when Tonya Harding was a kid, just ice skating prodigy, started skating around 3 years old, started competing by the time she was, you know, six or seven, and made it all the way up to being an actual Olympic contender by the time she was 22, 23 years old. The movie sort of focuses specifically on her relationships, these dysfunctional relationships in her life. Her father left early on. Her father was already like the third or fourth marriage of her mother. Her mother sort of is kind of a combination of sort of a abusive stage mom, like, you know, never giving her encouragement, always telling her that she could do better, always telling her that she's not doing it right, always, you know, on the side of the ice, hurling curse words at her in front of the other parents and making her feel terrible. Taking that abuse all the way home. Jeff Galooly, Sebastian Stan's character, they kind of play their relationship a little bit lovers on the run. Like they're really bad for each other. They have this toxic relationship, actually not too far off from the Joker Harley thing. talking about Margot Robbie. So that kind of gives you an idea of this sort of romanticized toxic relationship. This is pretty good. I'll say this about it. It's not terribly exceptional in the world of biopics, other than it's kind of rollicking, it's kind of fun. Mm-hmm. Like it has a little bit of a punk rock energy. It really, 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 really wants to be Goodfellas.
Okay.
It's aping that style and you know the narration and that sort of perspective, first person perspective, and switches perspective a little bit here or there. Like I said, in that middle bit when they get into the actual tabloidy stuff, which actually is the least interesting part of the movie as far as I'm concerned, because it's a little jarring and it's a little too style for the sake of style, It tries to cover it without going into it all that much. Like, we actually never get to know Nancy Kerrigan as a character. We see her like two or three times in the movie peripherally, but she's never really a part of the story. It stays always from Tonya Harding's perspective, which I get is a, you know, a screenplay choice and a movie choice, but it makes the drama of that particular incident not as impactful, in my opinion.
Okay.
But if there is a reason to see this movie, and it's okay, it's funny, it's fairly enjoyable, but if there's a reason to see this movie, it is Allison Janney. She is incredible in this movie. She is fire.
Yeah.
And we've seen her give 1,000 amazing performances before, and it comes from her so naturally. I think this is like up there with Laurie Metcalf, for competition of best supporting actress, for playing a complicated mother-daughter relationship. But she's really good in this movie. She's got to play like, you know, kind of a wide range of ages. You know, she plays from like middle age to old age, and it's all believable and it never looks weird. Whereas with Margot Robbie, it does look a little weird when she's trying to play 15 years old.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, does, I think Margot Robbie,
I love Allison Janney. I do think she, and I haven't seen this, Do you think she's in danger of being overly typecast as this type of character? Is this, this is different than kind of what we've seen from her before?
It's in the ballpark of what
it's in her wheelhouse.
It's in her wheelhouse, very much so. It's very similar to like her character from Drop Dead Gorgeous. But it's I think it's a little bit more nuanced.
Okay.
And I think it's almost like Drop Dead Gorgeous is the caricature version of this character.
Sure. All right.
Like that's the more sort of broadly comedic version of it. This one, she's funny and it's hilarious and she has these insane one-liners throughout the movie and she's, you know, biting and venomous, but she knows how to ride that line of like making you laugh for one line and then the next one making you gasp.
All right.
Like she has such fine-tuned control of this tightrope character that she's playing of like making you love to hate her and just hating her.
All right.
And like, you know, almost getting into like Mommy Dearest sort of camp, but never letting it slip that far.
Okay. And I mean, I don't want that to seem too critical. Like, you know, mm-hmm. the work you get.
She's a character actress.
Yeah.
And that's what she does. And I think she's done this so long that some of this probably is second nature to her. I'm just saying that she's the takeaway.
All right.
For me. And it's funny. And, you know, it'll remind you of the incident. It'll remind you of this whole, you know, Olympic drama if you were there to remember it. And you'll probably have some sort of nostalgia about it.
Mm-hmm.
If you like movies like Goodfellas or Wolf of Wall Street or Raging Bull, like, you'll see all of those visual and stylistic references in here. Some of it is a little eye rolling and it's like, okay, I get it. You're trying to do a Scorsese thing. But it does fit the tone of the sort of bratty way they decided to tell this story.
Okay.
And it's certainly entertaining, but I don't think it's quite there. If that makes any sense. I don't think it doesn't really go above being a showcase for a few really good performances.
All right. Yeah.
I do like directorially, I do like some of the stuff on the ice and some of the way that he shoots that. You know, you're kind of there with her as opposed to just shooting it like you would see it on CNN or not CNN, but like ESPN or something.
Mm-hmm.
You're kind of on the ice with her. And I like some of that sort of first person stuff. But yeah, largely. It's a big Goodfellas rip, but it's a halfway entertaining one. Let's go ahead and get into The Disaster Artist, and I'll let you set that up.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, yeah. So, if anyone who's listening isn't familiar with the movie The Room, this is a movie about that movie. It's about Tommy Wiseau, the director, writer, and star of The Room, which is
and producer,
mm-hmm. which is sort of notorious in Hollywood as the best worst movie.
Sure,
and so
one of,
and so this is about him meeting his friend and partner Greg Sestero. And how they moved to Los Angeles to become Hollywood stars, and that ultimately leads them to make this awful, terrible movie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's sort of it in a nutshell.
So The Room came out in 2003. It was originally released in 2003, which is where mm-hmm. this movie ends. But the cult of The Room doesn't really start until around 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
Which is when I discovered it in the message boards, the now deleted message boards on IMDb.
Yeah. Well, I think the sort of lore is that it was like some college kids found it and it sort of went like pre-viral.
Yes. I actually met the guy who created the Cult of the Room.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I took a class in grad school called about cult cinema, best class maybe I've ever took in my life. And if you
yeah,
know
that sounds right up your alley.
And the guy who taught it brought in the guy who discovered it, for lack of a better word. He was this guy. He had a small kind of thing on YouTube or whatever called 5 Second Films. Might still be a thing. I'm not sure. But he, as you find out from the movie, Tommy Wiseau, who's this strange, like, Eastern European, maybe. Nobody knows where he's from. Nobody knows how old he is. Nobody knows why he's independently wealthy, but he is. He's all of these things. He tells people he's from New Orleans, but clearly that's not where he's from originally. I heard somewhere,
I think it was on a podcast recently, that they think he might be from France, but he doesn't really have a French accent.
No,
it sounds more like
Eastern European.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Slavic.
It's a mystery.
He's the guy who came in for the class. The reason he saw the movie in the first place is because Tommy Wiseau paid for this huge advertisement, this huge billboard, and paid for it for months and months and months. At the same time, he was also four-walling his own movie in this theater in Pasadena, and basically just paying rent to keep the movie in there for as long as he thought he needed to keep it there. And nobody was going. Outside of the premiere, nobody was seeing this movie. He was just using his own money, of which there apparently is no bottom, to four-wall this crazy vanity project. The guy who, from 5 Second Films, kept driving past that billboard and said, I'm just going to go see this. Because it's just this weird, it's just the one sheet with Tommy Wiseau's weird face and the movie The Room and a link to a website. And he went and saw it by himself. There was nobody in the theater. And I think something like 30 minutes into the movie, he started texting everybody he knew and said, "You're coming to this later tonight." And then, you know, they brought their friends and their friends brought their friends and so on and so forth. I think the movie officially kind of spread out beyond being just a weird LA thing when Adult Swim started showing it edited.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This was like around 2008, 2009. I think even after I had already seen it. They started showing it, and then that's when it really spread out there. And now there is a movie motion picture based upon the book The Disaster Artist, which Greg Sestero wrote about the making of the movie.
Yeah, and I listened to an old interview he did on how did this get made,
mm-hmm.
and it was before the Disaster Artist book came out, so it's kind of interesting because you definitely get sort of a different version of the story from him in his interview than translated to this movie,
right?
And apparently, his book was originally called Trapped in the Room, which thank God he was working with another writer and. Came
a little on the nose, yeah.
Yeah, The Disaster Artist is a much better title, but right. So let's talk about this movie.
Yes.
So this movie, it sort of toes a line between being a movie about The Room and being a movie that's more interested in Tommy Wiseau as a character. And specifically Tommy Wiseau's relationship with Greg Sestero.
Sure.
Which I think was a really good choice for the movie.
Yeah.
I think this could have easily become sort of a look at this freak show project.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a enigmatic is a way to put it diplomatically.
Okay.
He's a strange dude. He's weird.
And eccentric.
Yeah. And I think it could have easily become like, look at how weird this dude is. But they chose to focus on this relationship to, I think, sort of ground it to give the audience any kind of stakes. Because if you'd never seen this movie, it's like, okay, this is just a movie about a bad movie, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's sort of what elevates this to beyond just like, let's point and laugh at this guy who could basically be like, if people didn't know this is based on a true story, they just think that James Franco's doing his version of Borat.
Yeah, just a really bizarre character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think that humanizing him was a good call. Mm-hmm. And I think made for a better narrative in general. But I do think I felt like I could maybe see where some of the truth was getting bent for that.
Sure. Yeah.
But I don't necessarily need a movie to be true.
No. And one of these kinds of movies, especially, where it's a truth is stranger than fiction kind of thing.
Yeah.
If you have to craft a narrative in there, you have to put a narrative through line, and they decided to go with the relationship between Greg Sestero and Tommy Wiseau, and sort of, you know, I think the ultimate message of the movie is sort of like, Tommy got the last laugh. Like, his movie's kind of this big joke, and it's this thing that people play at parties, and, you know, it's this, you know, if you've seen Troll 2 or you've seen Showgirls or you've seen Mommy Dearest or any of these kind of like So Bad They're Good, Reefer Madness type things, it's in that ballpark. Right. And yeah. And for my money, maybe the best one of them all. Yeah. Like,
well, I mean, I don't think you're not alone in that. Like, it's that's sort of its reputation as being.
Sure. I actually think that it is a perfect film, just not in any intentional way.
Yeah.
But I think it makes all the wrong decisions in exactly the right way.
Yes. And this movie does give us a peek into that. Like, right. And has, I think, a lot of fun doing it along the way.
Yeah. So I'll say this about it. I like that through line, that narrative thread that you're talking about, the story stuff between Tommy and Greg. Actually, I think that very similarly to how I felt about I, Tonya, I think the least interesting stuff is when they just are making the movie. Because at that point, I feel like the movie already says everything about itself. Like, there's nothing you can say, you know, behind the scenes that's going to sell how ridiculous that thing is better than the movie itself.
I get what you're saying, but also consider, even though this is a cult movie, this is a huge cult movie, it's still a cult movie. So I think that there are probably people who aren't familiar with it, probably similar to Tonya Harding. There's enough of a generational gap that they're trying to, they're not just saying here's a thing about a thing, they're also trying to show you some of that thing.
No, I understand. You need a certain amount of context for it to work at all.
Yeah, like,
but I almost feel like they're kind of shooting themselves in the foot with that, because I feel like you either know it or you don't. And the movie, I think, should hold up regardless. Like, I mean,
so you
and
seen...
I would actually argue that the reason why that stuff in the middle of them, you know, or the, you know, a pretty good chunk of the movie that is entertaining as a fan of The Room, I'm entertained to see like how they recreate certain scenes or the actors they got to play the other actors.
Mm-hmm.
I'm entertained to see like some of these snippets, like stuff I've read from The Disaster Artist, see how that they do that on screen, like him not being able to do the "Oh hi, Mark" line over and over again.
Yeah, well, so here's what I want to say to that though is mm-hmm. you're really familiar with this movie. You're the one that made me watch it. You've seen a lot more behind the scenes stuff than I have.
Mm-hmm.
I've only seen this movie the one time that you made me watch it, and that was enough for me. But seeing, like, I really appreciated seeing this stuff in the behind the scenes for two reasons. I thought mm-hmm. it made for some pretty pretty funny scenes
mm-hmm.
In this movie, The Disaster Artist. Mm-hmm. And I also it served as a reminder of how bad this movie is, because I kind of forgot a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it serves a character arc for Tommy, because this movie is about his friendship with Greg and how it, at first they're definitely friends and they're like building each other up. But mm-hmm. then once Tommy puts himself in a position of power, you know, we start to see sort of the ugly side of him and you know, how you could say how an auteur's passion takes over.
Sure.
And so I do think it serves a narrative purpose beyond just look at what we can do.
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying. I think that the making of stuff, like especially when it's talking about their relationship, which again is the stuff that holds it all together. Because I honestly think that without that, especially that big first act,
mm-hmm.
if it just started on day one of filming, this would be a mildly entertaining hour and a half long College Humor video.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Like honestly, I
swaths
think,
of it that kind of feel like that.
I think this movie had a way better screenplay than it sort of deserved, if that makes sense. Like, I think the way they built the story around this movie was pretty well done. I know they borrowed a lot from Ed Wood.
Right. Ed Wood, the Tim Burton film about the horrible filmmaker Ed Wood, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the gold standard of this type of thing.
Sure. I mean, I agree with you. Ed Wood's a great movie. And I think this kind of, I don't know, to me, this felt right up there with it, though. Like, I think by referencing that, it was a good benchmark to set. And that type of movie isn't done a whole lot, so it didn't felt it doesn't feel too overdone, you know what I mean?
Right. See, I actually think that the way your relationship to the room and you know, generally speaking, whoever's relationship to the room is going to determine how you feel about the feel about Disaster Artist. I think if you're like me, where you're super familiar with the movie, you've seen it more than once, if you've seen it more than three or four times, and you're also really familiar with the backstory already, I think it's going to be a little tedious. Not bad. Again, like sure. I, Tanya, entertaining, funny. James Franco is giving a great performance. I think it's a really terrific
Tommy Wiseau impression. I was going to talk about that next.
Yeah. I think if you're someone who's never seen the movie at all and is not even familiar with it, like you're coming into this completely cold, you're just going because you like the actors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what this is going to do for you. I'm going to say probably very little. You might find it mildly funny, but it's going to feel like an inside joke you're not inside of.
See, I think...
And I think that if you're somebody like you who's seen mm-hmm. it once a long time ago, you kind of remember it, but you kind of don't. But you get it. You know what the whole thing is about. I think that's probably the optimal place to be to see this movie.
Yeah, I think it might be a little hard for people who've never even heard of The Room.
Yeah, like if I took my dad to see this movie, I have no idea what he would laugh at, what he wouldn't.
And I think that's why this is a tricky story. And I think they pulled it off pretty well as far as that's concerned, because, you know, they are trying to make it as appealing as possible to as many people as possible.
Right.
So, yeah, I wanted to talk about... So, James Franco is... I think this is probably his best performance. I mean, he plays a weirdo really well.
Yeah.
I think
we know this.
Yeah. But I think... And he's been pretty vocal about how much he sort of sees himself and Tommy, and I think it shows. Like, this is definitely a passion project for him. I heard he even directed it in character, which is pretty fun and crazy.
That's very just, James Franco. Yeah,
and it just adds to the mystique of this movie, which kind of has its own mythology just in the way they've marketed it and just the fact that they even did it. It adds to the mythology of The Room. So I think James Franco is a great takeaway. And he's worth seeing the movie for. Some of the casting my friends in celebrity cameos took me out a little bit.
Yeah.
And was unnecessary. Like, I have mixed feelings about Dave Franco as Greg, because he doesn't really look or act like Greg to me. Right. Like, he's very Dave Franco. I think the fact that they're brothers did help, because they, you know, they do have a sense of chemistry.
An established relationship there. Yeah.
And I think they were going for that more than making Greg accurate.
More than verisimilitude.
Yeah. I think Greg is one of the big points of, like, this doesn't really feel honest. Like, even when he grows the beard, like, you can kind of tell it's a fake beard.
Yeah, you really can.
Which is a weird choice.
He looks in costume the entire movie.
Yeah,
and exactly. I actually think that that's, and you could say sort of the same thing about Josh Hutcherson and a few of the other characters in here too.
I do think some of the cameos worked, like Jason Mantzoukas and the guys who sell him the equipment.
Oh, Hannibal Buress.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Jesus. That was just, like, totally blanking.
I forgot he was in it, but yeah.
Like, they're such good sort of character actors, and I think cast to type well enough that they didn't really take me out. I really enjoyed Seth Rogen. I mean, he's definitely just being Seth Rogen, but I think it, again...
He's kind of heckling the movie from inside the movie.
Yeah, and I think
in a way that I actually was worried was going to be super annoying going in, but it felt welcomed, especially in that section of the movie for me, I felt was weaker than the rest of the movie.
Yeah. Well, he gives it a grounding I think it needed, because at this point, Greg has sort of drank the Kool-Aid. He's on Tommy's planet, and so it's nice to have that audience perspective. And so I really liked Seth Rogen in it. But some of the other ones, like Josh Hutcherson, Zac Efron, I was like, I think they could have cast those. I think maybe getting people who are less known, like Nathan Felder, would have been better choices, because it's like, oh, that's Zac Efron, and it took me out a little bit.
A little bit, yeah. I thought Zac Efron's scene was funny.
It was.
But yes, I know what you're saying.
He's so Zac Efron. That
part of the joke becomes that it's Zac Efron.
Yeah. And I don't think that's what they wanted it to be.
No.
So, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think that was necessarily in service to the vision for this movie. But for the most part, I will say I really enjoyed it. I think as a character study, James Franco's performance is so on that it's worth watching just for that alone.
Okay, I'm going to I'm not as favorable on this as you are. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I think it's entertaining, but I think it's not much more than that. For me, I think that Franco's performance is essentially just a really good impression. I don't get a whole lot more from it other than that.
I disagree.
I think the story that he builds around that is potentially interesting, but I think is undercut by the fact that ultimately it's just going up to, here's a bunch of callbacks to a cult movie. Like, and maybe this had to do with the audience I saw it with, but most of the laughs that were coming were from callbacks. Stuff that, like, oh, this is going to remind you of when you saw the movie. And there's a lot of jokes.
My audience was totally different. First of all,
there were natural laughs that came from this movie, that came from the screenplay.
Yeah.
But then, and that were not a part of expectations of the room. But there's a lot of stuff like in Franco's performance, like the laugh and stuff like that, that always got a laugh. And it was because they're remembering the room. And that's fine. That's how some people are going to experience a movie. It's not a wrong way to experience it. But I think it does speak to the fact that it's more of an impression than it is a performance. And see, I think the bigger problem with the narrative stuff is, for me, Dave Franco. I just don't think he's not.
Yeah.
He's not as committed, first of all, as Franco is to what he's doing. And it doesn't bring.
You just said Franco's not as committed as Franco.
Franco. They are both Francos. Dave Franco is not as committed to what.
Yes.
To what his older brother's doing, but he's supposed to be an everyman, but
you know, I'll give him credit. Greg Sestero, he's not a terribly interesting person.
No. Yeah. But I almost feel like you need to fill that spot with somebody who can do something with that, like somebody who can be professionally uninteresting.
I agree. I think little Davy Franks was definitely the weakest part of this for me.
But a very important part.
Yeah. Which is a little frustrating. I totally disagree with you about James Franco as Tommy Wiseau, though. I think he gives it more emotional range than we even know Tommy Wiseau's capable of.
Yeah, and maybe he isn't capable of, to be honest.
Yeah, like I think they give such heart to such a alienating human being. Like,
sure.
He's so strange that I think they had to probably downplay him a little bit. Because otherwise it's just going to be like, what the fuck is even happening? What is he even talking about? So I don't think that's fair to say that it's just an impression. I think he really emotionally rounds him out. It's very clear that there's a lot going on with this guy and that we just don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But Tommy understands it and he feels it.
Right. I'm of two minds of that performance, because it is technically brilliant, but it feels to me more of a technical achievement as far as a performance goes. Like it because there's these scenes, they show the side by sides at the end of the movie. You know,
sure.
Wait for the end of the movie. It's worth it, especially if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah.
The original movie, The Room. They show side by sides of them doing their version of the scene and then the actual scene playing simultaneously.
But they didn't show a lot of that in the actual
No, they don't
movie.
Show that in the actual... I mean, they show the behind the scenes of how they do certain scenes.
Yeah.
But this is the only time they actually do the side-by-side. But the point that I bring up is that with the other actors, you see them being off the line by a second or two or a slightly different cadence or whatever, but just close enough to get the point. Whereas with Franco... the audio syncs.
Yeah.
Because you can tell he like studied that movie and like was learning the lines along with the movie.
I don't understand how this is bad.
No, I'm not docking his performance for commitment. Like he's 100%, you know, balls deep in this thing.
But that's what I mean. Like I don't see what you're saying about how it's just an impression if he's the emotional core of the movie,
as much as there is one,
he takes. I think there is one. I think there for sure is one.
As much as well, and then maybe for me, it doesn't 100% work.
By the end of the movie, and I know what The Room is, I know how it turned out. I wanted him to succeed.
Yeah.
Like when he's at the premiere, and I like to me, that scene was sort of. Was really necessary because it's the culmination of this guy's dream and I don't know if Tommy was that aware of it that he felt the heartbreak like we see
in the movie.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that I thought, one of the reasons why I thought like the movie doesn't accomplish what it's trying to do is I felt that was very written. I felt like that was very a movie thing that had to be that had to be kind of in there to tell the arc of the story they're trying to tell.
Yeah.
And there's
that's what I'm talking about when I say it feels like it's not totally accurate, but but I think to tell a story, like I think we needed that from this character. I think we needed that emotional arc from Tommy Wiseau. Otherwise, I think it would have been just like, look at this weirdo. Isn't he so weird? You know what I mean? Like, I think that is important.
Other than a couple casting choices aside, it might be the best way you can do this movie. But I don't know. Ultimately, to me, it did feel like a vanity project about a vanity project.
All right.
And I think it's worth seeing, at the very least, as like a 2-hour special feature to The Room.
I think that's short selling it a little bit. I think that's short selling it a lot. I think this movie does say a lot about friendship, about, at what point is it okay to say fuck you to someone? Mm-hmm. I think they set out to tell a good story about that, and I think it was pretty successful as far as that goes. So I think that's short selling it to say it's nothing more than a vanity project.
Okay. So what would you
I actually really liked it a lot. But like you said, it might have to do with your relationship with The Room.
I really think it does. I think it changes a lot on it.
It probably is better for people who only partially familiar with it. I think that if you weren't familiar with it, but you have any kind of interest in bad movies, I think it would work. I think it would work. Like, remember the movie Bowfinger?
Sure. Yeah, and that's a funny movie. It's sort of in this genre.
Yeah, and it's totally fictional. And downplays it. So I think if you like that kind of sense of humor, this would work for you. If you'd never heard of The Room, I think this movie would A, make you want to see it, and B, I think it would be pretty good. I think it's for the people who are overly familiar with the phenomena of The Room. This probably doesn't do a lot for.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm really curious about that, especially if you're out there and you happen to catch this, but you weren't that familiar with it. I'd be interested to know what your opinion is.
There was a group of girls in our theater who I could tell had never seen it before. Who, when they were doing those side-by-side shots at the end, were kind of freaking out. They were just like, oh my God, I cannot. I can't handle this. They were kind of annoying, actually, but at the same time, I was sort of fascinated by them.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Something about it that I think is good, and what I was a little worried about was I was worried that this movie would sort of overshadow The Room, and it would become this thing where a lot of people end up seeing this movie but never really go back to see The Room.
This does the opposite. Like, this makes me really want to rewatch The Room.
Yeah, I actually don't think that this movie spoils watching the experience of just watching The Room. And I think people are going to be surprised by how not of an exaggeration some of this is.
Yeah, I think they probably downplay some stuff.
I think so, yeah. Cool. All right.
That's The Room. Give it a letter grade.
For me, it's a B-.
Okay, so I'd give it a B+.
All right, so we're actually not that far apart, but okay.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and talk about White Christmas.
You want to set this one up?
I'll set her up. This came out in 1954, directed by Michael Curtiz, previously done a lot of movies, including Yankee Doodle Dandy and Casablanca, among others. this stars Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye as these two military guys who meet in war. They find out that they make a good team as a singing duo, and they hit the road once they're released from the war. And Danny Kaye gets the idea that Bing Crosby's character, Bob Wallace...
Well, and specifically, Danny Kaye saves Bing Crosby's life.
Oh, yeah. That's kind of a big deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
he sort of edges his way into Bing Crosby's career.
Yeah, and he keeps through playing saving that his card life. Against him.
Yeah, throughout the movie. But he kind of gets this idea that they start to get a little cabin fever being around each other too much and touring and all of this stuff. And Danny Kaye decides that... that Bing Crosby needs a girlfriend, needs to get out and experience the world. So he takes him to this performance in which Rosemary Clooney and Vera Ellen play another singing duo. And he tries to play matchmaker with them, which leads them to going to Vermont to perform where it's supposed to be a white Christmas, but the weather, global warming was already starting in 1954, and they didn't get the white Christmas they thought they were going to get, so they might not have an audience because this ski resort is not bringing in anybody, so it's up to them to bring a bunch of people in the celebration of this resort, which is now owned by their ex general, who they sort of feel sorry for.
Yeah, who sort of doesn't have a place after World War II. Mm-hmm. His hotel is failing. Mm-hmm. So they want to get a bunch of the old troops to show up to surprise him, to show him that, you know, they're still loyal to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is like a big 50s musical in VistaVision, Technicolor.
Yeah, this is a real song and dancer.
Yeah, and you know, in there's a lot of these movies kind of from this time where it's
that
sort
Seth
of a
MacFarlane masturbates to.
Well, I've always thought. Sidebar: I've always thought that the movie I want to see Seth MacFarlane do if I was a career coach is for him to do a big takeoff on one of these kind of movies.
Yeah, but a Seth MacFarlane...
but like, a Seth MacFarlane kind of send-up, yeah. Like, yeah. It could be dirty and whatever, but to do it, just do it. Like, with these big song and dance numbers, because that's what he loves to do. But anyway, yeah.
No, I agree. I
do his version of, like...
That would make
the
most sense for him.
Right, of, like, a La La Land type thing, but, like, funny. This movie, I think it's one of those movies where there's a lot of song and dance numbers. It's just a loose enough narrative, just enough of a narrative framework to hang a bunch of song and dance numbers from.
Yeah, I mean, this is look at our stars.
Look at our production.
We got Bing Crosby. He's, you know, you're going to come, you're going to see a Bing Crosby album,
mm-hmm.
basically. Yeah. You're going to see Danny Kaye tap dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what they're selling. Those were the Marvel Hulk Buster versus Iron Man versus Hulk fights
of its day.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, this is big studio product of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, this is sort of a spiritual sequel to the movie Holiday Inn, which came out in the 40s. I want to say 42 or so. In which Bing Crosby is the main character as well. He doesn't play the same character, but he plays the lead, and he premiered the song.
But I mean, back
White Christmas
but
in
I mean
that
back
movie.
Then. Oh, really?
Yeah, he sings the song White Christmas. It became a huge radio hit off of the success of that film, in which they led them into making this movie about 10 years later.
Interesting. That's fun. But I mean, you know, back in the day, Bing Crosby's playing a character the way, you know, Jim Carrey plays a character in Liar Liar. Like,
sure, yeah.
You don't even remember the actual character's name because it's just Bing Crosby.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, to the point where it's like, just call him Bing.
Right. Yeah, or like the Spencer Tracy movies and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did you think of it? I mean, you know, that's a fun... you know, sort of movie history lesson, and I
holiday
think,
romp.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it. I like big corny musicals like this. I think the numbers are well produced. I think the camera work is actually very technical. There is a sort of a shallowness to it, but that is kind of sort of the point. Like you are kind of watching more of a almost like a show than you are a movie. And it is based on like an Irving Berlin. Yeah. Production. And so it has that feel to it, sort of a Broadway-ish sort of feel to it. It is, I think, more about its surfaces than it is about its characters. Now there's a little bit in there you could read into something about sort of the post-war masculinity being challenged and, finding a place after the war and like that kind of thing. There's a little bit of that if you really want to write it. If you want to write a paper Frazier's on it.
A comic book artist.
Don't worry.
Sorry. That was bugging me.
But I enjoyed it. I would say on a surface level, it's definitely worth seeing, especially to see one of these movies. If you like musical numbers and that type of stuff,
yeah, you could do worse.
You could do worse. The only thing that I think the movie sort of lacks is there's not much of a place of conflict. They sort of invent the tiniest amount of conflict towards the middle third to be able to have a story at all.
Yeah, and it's kind of ham-fisted.
Yeah,
and I don't. Okay, so here's my thing with it. The song and dance numbers were fun. As a sort of historical timepiece, it's interesting. It's definitely too long.
A little bit.
It's an hour in before they even get to Vermont. and I think especially a lot of the middle, they could have trimmed and cleaned up, like that whole train sequence with all the shenanigans getting to the train. I was like, just get to the fucking train and sing your train song. a lot of the story was just convoluted enough that I was getting kind of annoyed. Like I think the story with the general was the stronger story, and they should have just focused on that. And sort of cut out like the love drama. Like I don't think that like they could have just romanced. I didn't need the conflict in their story, if that makes sense.
No, I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So some of the songs were pretty fun. I my favorite was the one that Danny Kaye sang, that was like making fun of like modern dance.
Oh yeah.
In his black beatnik leotard. Turtleneck and I actually think that song was both a little ahead of its time and a little behind the time. that was a weird song to me because it's like this sort of postmodern take on postmodern art in a very traditionalist way.
Yeah.
So to me that was really interesting. I was like, oh, weird. What a weird take on beatnik culture. Like, I don't know. It was that one I thought was pretty fascinating.
Well, essentially in that specific thing, that number, that is the Greatest Generation weighing in on the baby boomer and weighing in on the beatnik generation.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's what I mean. It was done in a very postmodern way. Which is sort of the thing he's making fun of.
I don't know if I'd go so far as to call postmodern, but certainly satirical.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of postmodern. It was, I'm using my art to make fun of your art. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It was, that one was pretty interesting. And I think if you're not into the whole 2 hours and I think it can be kind of a slog. It's worth YouTubing at least that number, because I mean that was 1954. Like,
yeah,
that was I don't know, kind of on the
upswing of the beatnik culture.
Yeah, it's also vaguely homophobic. I don't want to call it so progressive.
Like, well, that's the thing. I don't think it was progressive. That's why it sort of pondered me. I pondered was a weird word to use there. But that's what I found so confounding was, I don't know, that scene just, I was like, what is going on here? That to me was the most interesting part of the movie. Some of the romance was nice, you know, and very old school. My complaint was just that it was too long. And there was, for a movie called White Christmas, there's not a lot of white and not a lot of Christmas.
Well, a lot of white people.
Well, sure. Yeah. It was 1954.
It was 1954.
I just mean, like, I wouldn't really consider this a Christmas movie.
It barely, yeah. It kind of, like, it sneaks in there.
It starts with a Christmas scene, and I thought that's the opening sequence was really pretty. Like, I thought the movie was going to be a lot more dour. Because it starts there. With Christmas in World War II. Mm. And Bing Crosby's
bombs like going off,
singing to the troops and singing White Christmas, which is kind of a sad Christmas song.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, Jesus, is this going to be kind of rough? And then it's like, nope, we're immediately back from the war and we're entertaining. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. I actually like the relationship between Bing Crosby and Danny Kaye. And their comedic exchanges work. I think Bing Crosby, considering he's a singer, dancer, actor, performer, but a lot of those guys were at that time. And I think he's very natural in this. Yeah. And that's sort of his appeal, is he's just the most natural. Even his singing style is very not off the cuff. It's certainly trained, but it's has that kind of lackadaisical quality that people like.
Yeah.
Whereas Kay has a little bit more of sort of a manic energy in the movie. It's more of the character between the two.
Yeah, I thought they were a pretty fun pair. Same with the women. I thought they were good. The Haynes sisters. I mean, if I had any complaint there, it's that Bing Crosby's obviously older than all of them.
Sure.
But, you know, they hide it with makeup and it's fine.
Yeah, the movie is so artifice laden that it's kind of hard to make those sort of distinctions.
Well, and you know, in the 50s in Hollywood, it wasn't weird to have a leading man that was 25 years older than his leading woman.
I'm not so sure if it's that much weirder now.
No, it's not. I mean, you know, I could see George Clooney paired up with someone,
Scarlett Johansson or something.
Yeah. And you know, some people wouldn't blink an eye.
No.
I'm getting a little more sensitive to that as an audience member. But yeah, it's fine. I don't know. If you like big old song and dance movies, I think you probably already seen this.
Yeah. You already have the album. You play it every year.
Yeah. Which we do have a Bing Crosby album, and we do listen to it every year. You know, but as far as a movie goes, I don't think a lot of younger generation will probably appreciate it.
Yeah, I don't know how much, unless you're like a musical theater geek.
Yeah, or a film buff, you know, and you are interested in that.
I mean, it's gorgeous. Like the production design and the Technicolor and all that stuff. I love the way these old movies look.
Yeah.
Everything's really vibrant. The costumes are crazy. I like all of that. I would agree. I think the way to watch this movie, if you're gonna see it and you haven't seen it before and you've just heard a lot about it, is think of it more as a show than a movie.
Yeah.
It's almost like a variety show. I mean, little bit of a story to connect, to go from number to number, from set piece to set piece, but it's more about the performances.
Yeah, there really isn't much more there than, say, the Bill Murray Christmas special that Netflix did.
Oh, God, that thing. No, it's far better than that.
Okay.
That thing was horrid.
No.
Horrid.
I enjoyed it.
We don't need to get into it. We don't need to get into that.
No, I think we might get into it. How is it any
Oh, me and Richard reviewed that, like, I think the year, like, last year or the year before. Go back and listen to it if you're really interested. I don't, this movie's fine. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I think it is, I don't know. You said it's not all that Christmassy, but I certainly can imagine a different time of the year I would just watch this on its own.
See, it's not, I wanted it to be more Christmassy. Like, they, you know, they, it's really only the first scene and the end scene.
Yeah.
Everything else is pretty.
It takes place in the Christmas season.
Yeah, but you don't really get a sense of that.
Nah, not so
much. I mean, like, you know, the inn they're staying at isn't decorated like Christmas. Their shows previous to that don't really take place at Christmas. There's not like Christmas set dressings until the very end, and then it's like, oh, here's the big Christmas costumes and the big Christmas number.
Well, I think I don't think it was originally made to be a Christmas movie in the way that we think of Christmas movies.
It's called White Christmas.
As a genre, though, I think and I've never seen Holiday Inn, but I would imagine a lot of this is probably calling back to that, because I think it has a pretty similar plot.
Sure.
As far as people doing big performances at some sort of, you know, club or dance thing or whatever. But I think that, I think a lot of people were seeing this more for the Bing Crosby Holiday Inn factor than let's go see a good Christmas movie.
I don't like that. It's called White Christmas. Mm-hmm. I want it to be fucking Christmassy.
This is part of the big three. I would say if there's like, you know, three classic Christmas movies that people think about, it's this, It's a Wonderful Life, and Miracle on 34th Street.
Well, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Miracle on 34th Street and It's a Wonderful Life, those are fucking Christmas movies. This isn't really.
Mm-hmm.
This and is then, more about Bing Crosby getting his dick wet.
It kind of is about that.
It's kind of exactly about that.
Yeah. All right, so the next time we do an episode, we don't know exactly when that's going to be, but the next time we do an episode, which will be our top 10, and maybe a bottom 5 as well. For the Netflix homework, we are going to talk about what?
I'm assigning you the Netflix original blockbuster, the first one that Netflix has done, Bright, starring Will Smith.
Mm-hmm, and an orc.
Well, it's, what's his name?
Joel Edgerton, yeah.
Yeah.
And I believe it's directed by David Ayer and written by Max Landis.
Yes.
So we'll get into that. I guess that's it. That's the show. And if anybody has any responses to anything we talked about today, you can do so at our email, jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also contact us on Twitter at Jabber Podcast. You can contact me individually at BC Cassidy. You can find the show or stream us at Podbean, which is our main archives at Jabber and Drone.
Especially give me a shout out if you enjoyed a Bill Murray Christmas.
give Keith a shout out. Give him some validation on the Bill Murray Christmas controversy.
I mean, it's not like amazing, but it was just meant to be like a fluffy Christmas special.
If you say so. We are available to stream.
It's barely even a movie.
Exactly.
Or you wouldn't have been disappointed if you had seen it live.
At Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, Player.fm, Google Play, Windows Podcast Network, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, the two most popular ones. And where do people find you, Keith?
You can follow me on Twitter. You can follow me on Instagram at Keith Foster Kid. Find me on Facebook. That's it right now. Tonight in San Diego. Do all that.
Do all of that.
We're going into a new year. We're going into some changes. We'll see. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. We have other friends who do podcasts that you should be listening to, including Rod and Denise at The Listening Party. They'll be premiering their new format here in, I think, the next month or so. Listen to Denise's solo podcast, Mascot Diaries. Listen to Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational and Patrick and his father at Make Dad Read Comics. Mike Fallick, who we've been talking to a lot on Twitter, at Let's Start a Cult, and Bill and Brian at the Great Albums Podcast. I suggested to them doing an EPs month. We'll see if they take that suggestion.
They should do it in February.
Yeah, shortest month of the year, right?
Yeah.
Such a good idea. I think I might text them. Okay, so that's it.
Give it to Gosling.